The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So tonight we continue with our Lojong teachings, point 3, transform bad circumstances into the path. And we've been investigating these slogans under this category for the last day or two. And they are so in alignment with our practice of Zen to meet everything that arises as reality. And this is just noticing circumstances and recognizing that no matter what our opinion of them is, they are the arising of the Dharma, the arising of the Buddha nature, the awakened heart showing itself as both things we like and things we don't like. And tonight our investigation goes to the 15th slogan, which Norm Fisher translates as, do good, avoid evil, appreciate your lunacy, pray for help. Beautiful version of what is it's both simpler and more complicated in Chogyam Trungpa's version. So Trungpa calls this the four practices, and his slogan rendered into English is, four practices are the best of methods. So the four practices are, do good, avoid evil, appreciate your lunacy, and pray for help. So doing good and avoiding evil are very much in alignment with our precepts. To practice good, to avoid evil, and to save all beings. The three so-called pure precepts that are part of our 16 bodhisattva precepts that we take when we take the precepts in our Jukai ceremony. And these three are extremely clear, simple, and of course really, really complicated, because anything that's as simple as this is complicated. And this doing good and avoiding evil, I suspect, and I think even Fisher says this in his book, that he used this language because it is so in alignment with the Zen precept teachings. But Trungpa Rinpoche talks about them just a little bit differently. These first two, he calls the first one accumulating merit, and the second one he calls laying down evil deeds. And so accumulating merit is a very ancient tradition in Buddhisms of all kinds. No matter where Buddhism arises, accumulating merit is always a part of it. And traditionally, the way we accumulate merit is that we do things in the name of the Dharma that will help to maintain the Dharma. So founding a temple, starting a practice group, teaching, donating money to a practice group or a temple or a Zen organization. All of these things are traditional ways that people all over the world accumulate merit. Now, in our teachings, of course, accumulating merit is seen as only temporary, and that who is the one, in fact, who accumulates merit? We say there is no one to accumulate merit, so what are you talking about? And Bodhidharma, famously, when he came from India to China and met the Emperor Wu, who was a Buddhist practitioner who had done a lot of merit accumulating. He'd founded temples and supported priests and teachers and sanghas, and he wanted to know how much merit he had accumulated through doing all these wonderful things. And Bodhidharma famously said, no merit. And there's a calligraphy out in our hallway that was given to David by Josh Bartok Roshi, now the guiding spiritual director of the Greater Boston Zen Center. And it was given to David on the occasion of his transmission. So a wonderful warning from a fellow teacher to a fellow teacher. Do not get caught in thinking that you can accumulate anything ranks and prestige, it's all nothing, because there is actually nothing at the base of everything. And we keep reminding ourselves of this all the time in Zen. And Trungpa too, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was a Tibetan teacher who had escaped Tibet and lived in Nepal, then went to Scotland, and then came to the United States to teach, and died very young, tragically young, in his 40s. Just a brilliant communicator and practitioner, and lots of amazing things that he did for the Dharma, founding monasteries, Naropa University, lots of opportunities for people to study the Dharma, and his own books and talks and training of other teachers. And he was also a person who did a lot of terrible stuff. He didn't follow the precepts literally whatsoever. And I won't get into all the terrible things that he did, but you could just imagine. It's a long list. And he was very clear. I never met him, but I knew people who knew him and studied with him or learned from him in various ways. He never pretended that he was a perfect human being. He never pretended that doing good or accumulating merit was something that buoyed him up. He was a great practitioner of no merit. And so when he teaches about this this practice of doing good deeds to accumulate merit, he understands the emptiness of the doing of good deeds and is very clear about it, that we do all these things and we do them simply because this is the only thing we can do. There's no other way. Very important to see through the false idea of a self that can improve. This is why we say Zen is not about self-improvement, and we mean that literally. We are not trying to improve the self. We're not trying to get better at being a human being. Although, as we say, and as David said earlier today in his talk, we do grow in wisdom and compassion. This does happen, but not through just doing good stuff for people. Norman Fisher talks about this particular practice as just being kind to people, smiling and assisting people when they need help. All of these things grounded in the Dharma, but empty, just doing, but not making into anything. So this is the first practice of accumulating merit, and then we have to give it away. And the second one, I just love the translation here. It's not avoid evil, but laying down evil deeds. And who among us has not done things that we regret, as Alan did last night? We're all supposed to be sitting here without moving, and he said, raise your hands if you have, I can't remember what it was. And of course, a couple of people did, forgetting that once the bell rings, we're not supposed to move, but what the heck. But so internally, as Alan suggested yesterday, raising your hand internally in your own heart if you've ever done anything that you regret. And boy, I think there is some classification in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders where there are people who have no regrets. And those people cause lots of harm in the world. But most of us have regrets. We look back and we go, oh, I wish I had done this or that or the other thing. Some of us can become endlessly preoccupied with those things, and I still love Jenny's metaphor of the puppet show in the mind. We enact all these endless little theatrics internally, trying to fix the past. Some of you know that I love to watch television, and I get a lot of Dharma teachings from television programs. And my favorite television program on this topic is called Being Erica, and it's about a young woman who meets a mystical psychotherapist who asks her to make a list of her regrets. And she does, and it's a long list. And to the writer's credit, if you freeze frame on that list, all the episodes that follow follow that list exactly. And she gets sent back in time as herself, as a 30-something-year-old woman, to be a teenager who does this, or a young girl who does that, or a 20-year-old who does this. And she gets a chance to repair the past. And what she finds is that it doesn't work the way she thinks it is. So she does do things differently. She doesn't get drunk at the prom. But things still unfold in ways that are unexpected. This is how karma is. There's no way to fix the past. Other mistakes get made, and there's a certain point in the series where she recognizes that you can't go back and change everything. You have to live now. And this is what laying down evil deeds is directing us towards. Laying down evil deeds is saying, yep, I did this, and now I'm owning it, and now I'm living here in the middle of the consequences of the things that I did in the past. This is so sensible and so difficult, but it's very important, and it is the second practice. So laying down evil deeds, everything we've ever done that we consider wrong or harmful, even if we didn't know it at the time, we have to, as Trungpa says, face reality. This actually happened. Now what? This is what it is like now, based on all the zillions and zillions of things that have happened right up to now, including all the places that I have screwed up. And it's very refreshing to practice this particular one. I've been practicing it a little bit, David and I were actually talking about it earlier. It eases the heart. It's not that we don't repent our actions, because that's also part of laying down evil deeds, to say, oh, I did this thing, it caused harm. And we say in our atonement gatha that now I atone for it all. All the guiding teachers in Boundless Way worked on that line for a long, long time to make it represent this kind of teaching, that now, in this moment, now, I atone for it all. Not I will atone for it, you know, I'll do something that will fix things, or I repent of it, I'm so sorry, I'll just endlessly apologize, but no, I will atone for it right now in this moment by living a life of increased awareness, seeing more and more what it's like to be a human being who can't know everything, most of us always doing our best and then screwing up royally, as we say, and then sometimes not knowing it until quite a bit later, sometimes knowing it right in the next moment. Over and over again, this is happening. So these are the first two practices to accumulate merit and to lay down evil deeds. And then the last two are lots of fun. They're fun because they root themselves in the practices of recognizing that the world, as we know it, is full of all kinds of mystical forces that take shape in our own hearts and minds as beings, as gods and demons. The world is filled with these gods and demons, and you can look at this as metaphoric or psychological. So the metaphoric view is that yes, there are all these forces of good and evil, gods and demons, or angels and demons. And in some religions, you know, they do talk about angels. The metaphor is, yes, there are forces of good and forces of evil constantly roiling around, and we get to be aware of them in our own hearts and minds. And this is the psychological interpretation, that all of the demons in the world, all of the gods and positive forces, are just different parts of ourselves, and we can engage with them in all these different ways. But in traditional Buddhism, in Tibet and in Southeast Asia and in the Central Asian countries of China and Japan and Korea and Vietnam, where Zen comes from, these are not metaphoric or psychological. They really are forces in the world of evil and good. And we chant to them. Norman Fisher points this out. When we chant to the bodhisattvas throughout space and time, the Buddhas and bodhisattvas throughout space and time, that is a very particular calling out to these mystical beings. The teachings of the Great Vehicle that Zen and Tibetan Buddhism are part of say that the Buddha never died, but lived on as Buddha nature, and that the world is actually full of Buddhas. There we talk about fields of Buddhas, the Buddha field, and it's just packed with Buddhas. There's no room for anything else. It's like a big crowd of Buddhas throughout space and time, we say in our chant. And this is serious. This is not some kind of very sweet poetic thing. Everywhere we look, Buddhas, Buddhas, Buddhas. And you know, on the psychological level, we could say that everyone we meet who's kind to us is showing us that Buddhas are everywhere. Everyone we meet who is cruel to us are showing us that demons are everywhere. And the sweet mythological, mystical view is that, no, really, they really are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and demons everywhere. When we give transmission to someone, and we just did this the other night for Mike Felicki, who's now a sensei, he was here earlier today, we had somebody take the kiyosaku, the encouragement stick, the sword. It represents the sword that cuts through delusion, the sword that gives life and takes life away. And we had actually his wife, Sandra, held the stick to guard against demons interfering with the ceremony. We really do that, and maybe we do it metaphorically or psychologically, but while the ceremony was going on, we heard all this weird noise from outside, this screaming and roaring, and, you know, I'm serious, this really happened. And luckily, Alan was at the ceremony, and he said, oh, those are just raccoons in the trees. And I thought to myself, raccoons in the trees? Well, okay. I believe that. I didn't know that raccoons were out in the trees, but now I believe that they do climb trees and scream and shout during transmission ceremonies. But maybe they were the demons that were trying to prevent David from giving transmission to Mike. I don't know. There's more things in heaven and earth, as they say. So one of the things that we say is that, and this is how Chögyam Trungpa talks about this, he says we need to make offerings to the demons. We need to appease them. They're called the duns in Tibetan. And they are these forces that try to screw us up. And we have a little practice that I learned from an American woman who's a Tibetan teacher, Tsultrim Alioni. She's actually written a book about it called Feeding the Demons. You literally make offerings to them in Tibetan Buddhism. You make these little cakes and leave them out so they're preoccupied and they won't bother you during ceremonies. And yeah, that really happens too. So, and you know, we give food to the Buddha up on the altar. All these wonderful folkloric, metaphorical, mythological things that we've inherited from our ancestors. We can be real rationalists and say, no, that doesn't happen. But man, I heard those raccoons, and I don't know. So we offer ourselves to the demons. We ask them what they want. The demon of anger, the demon of fear, the demon of anxiety and depression and impatience. And we say, what do you want? And in the practice of feeding the demons, almost always what the demons want is you. They want everything. They want to just eat us up. And so we give ourselves to the demons. We make offerings to the demons. And then the last one, and I should say that Norman Fisher's translation for this particular thing is to appreciate your lunacy, because those demons are us. And we are actually made up of all these forces, all these different energies that are sometimes quite destructive internally and even externally. And so to appreciate these things, to appreciate the demons that live inside of us, that live in the world, the demons of division and war and anger and fighting and all the terrible things that human beings do to each other are demonic forces. And so how do we cope with them? We offer our whole being to them. We stop being wedded to the little sense of me the one who needs to accumulate merit or to avoid evil. We are just completely sacrificing all the parts of ourselves to these demonic forces. And then the fourth part is, Norb Fisher says, it's to pray for help. And Chögyam Trungpa says this is offering to the Dharmapalas. The Dharmapalas, which are like the gods, or literally the protectors of the teaching, the protectors of the Dharma. And these forces too, these are the Buddha fields, the Buddhas everywhere. These are the beings who strangely help us and appear to us internally and externally in surprising ways. The appearance of these Dharma protectors, we don't have to believe in them. In fact, I would recommend you don't believe in any of this unless you've experienced it for yourself. And even then, maybe a grain of salt is required. But there is the possibility that there is benevolence in the universe. And if we ask for it, if we say, please help me, that help comes. Prayer is a very big deal in the theistic religions. We pray to God or to the gods or to the saints, and they respond. And in our Om Nam chant, we call out with all of our sincerity and our heart, and we wait for a response, this call and response to the universe. And sometimes clarity arises in those moments after we've called out. Prayer is a very powerful thing. For me, I think it's just the attitude of recognizing that I cannot do this myself. And so I say to the universe, please help me. I actually say that on a regular basis when I've come to the end of my rope. And always something shifts, and I consider that the help that I've been longing for. So these are the four practices that are part of this section, transform bad circumstances into the path. This is how we do it. Trungpa says, four practices are the best of methods: accumulating merit, laying down evil deeds, offering to the demons, and offering to the protectors of the teachings. This is the fourfold practice of stopping being attached to the sense of a small self and recognizing that we are embedded in a hugely complicated network of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, demons and angels, human beings, birds, trees, raccoons screaming in the trees, everything, so crowded with presence that all we have to do is rest in this wild world and allow the Dharma to unfold in our hearts. So we'll just take a moment now to sit in the presence of all of these wild and wonderful beings, and then the bell will ring and we'll move to walking meditation.